everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. I'm excited because today I have a guest that I adore. Just one of those amazing human beings that we don't have enough of on this planet. And I mean that with all my heart. I have with me Robert Grillo, the founder and director of Free From Harm. Robert, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Karen. It's great to be back on your show and to have connected with you in Chicago recently. It was wonderful.
Yes. I want to talk about that a little bit later. But I remember when I first found out about your organization and I was like, oh, this is an interesting group. You're doing some great stuff. But I was really blown away when I finally got to talk to you. You just, and I could tell from talking to you and your energy, what kind of wonderful person you are. I don't say that to everybody, do I, everybody? Anyway, I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but.
That's very sweet.
You're good.
I actually thought my energy was manic when I spoke to you the first time. I felt like I was going a mile a minute. There was so much I wanted to get into a small space and time. And I feel like I just kind of went crazy overboard, but that's okay. You know,
that's okay. You know, that's part of one of the questions I wanted to ask you. So you started this in 2009 and that was 13 years ago almost, right?
Right.
So what has changed for you in this arc, this process of running a nonprofit and doing the work that you do in terms of your own presence and how you manage things?
Yeah, you know, every day you learn so much, right? It just feels like, you know, there's new challenges, there's new obstacles, there's new lessons. Even when you lose something, I feel like losing is as important as winning because the lessons are equally valuable. And sometimes the lessons you learn from losing are even more important because if you don't apply those to the future, you know, you could be in big trouble. So, you know, I feel like what kind of makes us a little different is that we strive for structure and organization and better standards, better organization, streamlining of things, making things work better. But at the same time, I feel like it really is important to balance that with thinking outside of the box and not becoming too much of a routine or formula, because good activism requires keeping your targets and the public and everyone kind of on their toes so that they don't anticipate and say, oh, how predictable. You know, they use those props. Or, you know, we have to do something that kind of captures the society's attention in a way that garners respect and awe, hopefully, like maybe makes them think rather than necessarily laugh at us or make us think, you know, we're always going to have critics and people that attack us and think that we're stupid and are, you know, we're messed up. But we can also do things that, you know, that kind of create, you know, create a situation where people kind of have to think about it. And so I just feel like it's important to continually evolve and look for new ways to present ourselves. And I feel like it's kind of a theater in a way. I feel like the role of an activist is playing a role that's not necessarily us. It's the role we have to play to strategically pursue the goal.
Okay, now I think that we're reading each other's minds. When you said theater, you just gave me chills because I was just going to say exactly the same thing. And I was going to say, you know, I'm involved in theater and the kind of theater that I like is the theater that makes you think, not the kind of theater that makes you laugh, just as you just explained with your work. And then you said it's like theater. So, okay, mind blown. Boop.
Not that we shouldn't laugh, right?
And no, laughter is important.
Yeah.
But definitely we need to think and we need to see ourselves and really understand what we're doing, what our actions are doing, and not be sleepwalking. But most people are. Not that I'm judging.
Right.
Okay, so free from harm. Has your mission changed at all in the last 13 years, or just maybe your focus or direction?
Yeah, it's changed with, you know, I think what we learned. And that I think at the beginning, we didn't really have a sense for, we weren't very well informed. You know, we had to learn as we were going, and we didn't know about activism strategy. We didn't know about psychological factors that influence people's decisions on what they buy. We learned so much about those things. And so the mission has changed based on what we think is necessary for the kind of change that we want to see in the world, if that's possible. And at this point, I think, you know, what we're facing is so serious in terms of, you know, ecological and climate change circumstances that I think it would be disingenuous to not advocate for anything less than a complete transformation of the food system and the thought process behind our food. I mean, I think certainly we'll probably get there in steps, but to me, the negotiation between what we want and what we're willing to settle for doesn't start with asking just for what we want to settle for, which is what I'm seeing a lot. Groups asking, well, let's get them 2 more inches of cage space and then move on. Well, I don't think negotiation works that way. I think you have to ask for more than what you want and then be willing to settle for what you're willing to settle for. So to me, that it's like counterintuitive the way I see the approaches from like a lot of the larger groups.
Well, the larger groups like you're talking about, I've talked to some of them and they'll say that they're happy to get what they get because it's so hard. And right. I'm not sitting in their negotiation, so I don't know what they're leading with and what they're playing. But how do you feel about that?
Well,
because you just said, you know, you ask for the world, right? And then you end up settling. And to some extent, that's what they're doing, unless maybe they're not asking for the world. I don't know. Maybe they're tiptoeing and being careful.
Right.
How would you talk to Tyson and Smithfield and all the bad boys?
Well, I think what their approach is that if we only rely on lobbying and wheeling and dealing in Washington with elected officials and lobbyists and stuff, if your sole tactic is lobbying, then I've heard from some of the best lobbyists, one in Chicago here, who's a great lobbyist and worked with us for a while, but always complained about how difficult it was to get anything passed, even the most minuscule animal protection law. And we used to have these conversations, and I would say the reason why only relying on lobbying seems like we can't move anything is because it takes a lot more than just lobbying. It takes grassroots activism on a scale that is larger than we have, which mm-hmm. we have not organized and developed to the point it needs to be. And until larger groups are willing to kind of, you know, embrace that, I think we will have short, small victories where we could actually, I think, have broader, more dramatic ones if we just become, if we build more of an activist community. I think that's really, really what's missing right now.
I agree with you. I feel like these organizations in some way kind of dismiss the power of the grassroots. And that's how they all got started. That's how they got to where they are today. But now they're so big and important that, you know, the little people don't matter, but the little people are all that matter. If there were more of us complaining all the time and saying what was necessary, I think things would move a lot more quickly.
Yeah, I agree. And I look at other social movements. And if we see what's going on there, like, for example, with the Black Lives Matter movement, George Floyd and other, you know, tragedies that took place, really, Black Lives Matter's response to that and other racial justice groups was to escalate, to step up their activities. And it worked in the sense that if you looked at some of the polls about acceptance of Black Lives Matter as a group and their message, racial justice or whatever it was, there were various messages, obviously, from defund the police to, you know, reform that whole system. But acceptance was up 65% from something much smaller than that. And I really have to, you know, I think we see this playing out in other movements, but we're not learning those lessons about how they did it. And it frustrates me sometimes.
Sure. And I'm not exactly sure how they did it or how the timing was right, because, you know, things have been going on like this for hundreds of years, unfortunately. And finally, we hit some sort of button that released.
Right.
And with animals, I mean, what kind of horrible nightmare disaster has to happen in order for people to all of a sudden wake up? Because what are we killing? 60, 70 billion land animals, not even including the life in underwater. What's it going to take? Occasionally, everybody gets all excited when a cow escapes the slaughterhouse and everybody's cheering for the cow, but it's never enough.
Right. It's not sustained. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we often ask ourselves that too. And I guess where we are is different than what's different in our movement, I guess, with the others, is that we're chipping away at the foundations of this huge, you know, exploitative system that exploits animals. And we're looking for ways where we can deal a really serious blow to that structure. And we're trying a lot of different things. It's trial and error, just like advertising is trial and error. And corporations have learned the psychology too. They use disruption to disrupt consumers and create new markets to get them to think that by using advertising, they can disrupt people's thinking, change their minds, and make them think there's something new that they need, that they never knew before, that they needed it.
Right.
That's not unique to corporations. That's a social psychology methodology that social movements use too. And corporations just decided, hey, this could work for us too. You know, so like, we need to disrupt the system to change it. And so it's not a dirty word. Like, you know, like advertisers do it too. to create new markets and to change consumers' minds. So sure.
There are a lot of tools out there that can be used for good and not so good. Yep.
That's right.
Okay. So I'm looking forward to Free From Harm's big punch. All right. One more question about the organization, just in general. In the last 13 years, what have been some of your favorite accomplishments or best work?
Well, recently, one of the wins that we had was surprising, rewarding, shocking, all in one, and to everyone, I think. And that was after a year, when we learned that we were trying to help our slaughter-free Milwaukee team, after they learned that there was a $74 million slaughterhouse being proposed outside of Milwaukee. And we learned that the Strauss company sold most of its shares to an investment firm that's based in Texas. And the CEO of that investment firm was a deep sea diver, celebrity, was on publicly talking about, you know, how he rescues dogs and respects the ocean and how we have to really care for our oceans. And here he is investing in the slaughterhouse industry.
Wow.
We launched a calling and emailing campaign. We had his mobile phone. We got his mobile phone number. For the course of a year, off and on, we told people to call and email him, but nothing worked. That didn't work. And then last October, we organized a protest. We found out where he lived, and our Slaughter Free Dallas group did a protest at his house. Well, I tried calling him a few days after that, and it was the first time he actually ever took my phone call.
Wow.
And it was a long and productive conversation, and we both agreed that it was all about why it's not a good idea to invest in a slaughterhouse, all the different reasons. And we both listened to each other. We both had lots to say, and we both listened to each other. It was very respectful, and we both agreed at the end that it was really productive. But the funny thing was the conversation started out as him complaining about how bad, how rude our tactics are. And I thought, I was listening to this and I was thinking how ironic that was, because the only reason why we were on the phone was because we did a protest at his house. And he was embarrassed by it. His neighbors saw what was going on, and you know, there was all this drama out there. So no one likes that, of course, but that was the only way to get him to come to a dialogue. And so we had this wonderful conversation. And then 5 days later, we got an email saying that the company was no longer investing in the $74 million slaughterhouse. They were meeting our demand we asked them to divest from the project. And but they said, not only are we're divesting from that, but we're also not investing in any other slaughterhouse projects anywhere. So, and that was it. And they didn't want to have any more dialogue with us. That was it. They're like, we're done. Okay. Yeah. So.
Wow. Well done.
Replicate that.
Right.
You know.
Did you ask him when he said you had been rude if there had been another way you could have gotten his attention?
That's a very good question. No, I didn't think to ask that. Should have had you on the call too.
Yeah, right.
But actually what I did ask was, I said, you know, I wish we could have had this conversation a year ago when you noticed that we were starting to call. And we said, if we can't talk, we have a lot of, you know, unhappy supporters that are going to want to contact you. But we can save you all that if you just talk to us. So all we wanted from the very beginning was dialogue. And so I kind of reiterated that.
When you had the conversation, did you change his mind? Did he not understand what he was going to invest in?
I think to a certain extent, that he had not heard these arguments before about the slaughterhouse industry. And I think he was rattled. I think he was truly rattled by it. The other thing that I thought was really interesting about his some of his responses was how much it was important to him to impress upon me that he was a good person and that he cared about the environment. He drove a Tesla, which of course none of us can afford. but hey, he's a billionaire. He drove a Tesla. He did this, that, and the other thing. And I said, I honored that. I said, that's great. I could sense that, he was looking for common ground and that people want to be seen as good people.
Yeah.
That's the lesson that came away from that.
Right. I'm sorry. Oh, yeah. You always have to find common ground some way and then go from there. Well, good for you. So what happened with that slaughterhouse?
So the interesting thing is that the community group in the town where it was proposed still has an ongoing lawsuit with the Strauss company, even though Insight Equity, which is the company that owns a huge part of it, and Strauss publicly announced they were backing out of the project. Mm. So, done deal. Our understanding is, it's too much of a hassle for them, too much resistance. It's ruined their reputation. All the Strauss family, I think, really cares about right now is being able to sell this land and, close up shop, cut their losses. Mm. Mm-hmm. It's been a nightmare.
Right.
So
that land could be used for something else, right?
Right.
Like a sanctuary.
or even if they need some commercial development and they need jobs in this town, then even then there's many kinds of agriculture, right? Hemp farming, mushrooms.
Yes, yes, there are many kinds of agriculture. Hello, there's so many things that we could be growing and do it sustainably in a way that nourishes the soil, because I've been doing a lot of reading about the soil and how dead our soil has become and is becoming, and how if we regenerate, and it's not that difficult to regenerate, and it's not that difficult to bring the life back, we could take in a lot more carbon very quickly. It's really actually exciting to know what's feasible without really investing in anything, without really doing anything major other than doing what the earth wants us to do, bring the soil back to life, and it will work wonders.
Right. Yeah.
It's good to know it's out there. I'm an optimistic realist, perhaps.
Yeah.
I want to have hope. I want to know that there are options and things we could do, but at the same time, we're in big trouble.
Yeah, right.
We're in big trouble.
Hope is a big thing, and so is Larry Kramer of ACT UP.
Yeah.
For him, it was outrage that kept him so driven to do such great work. And
outrage is a motivating factor, but it's not healthy to live in outrage.
Not in a constant state of it. No.
Yep.
No, I agree.
Okay, so what's happening today? Can we talk about bird flu?
Sure. I looked at the map and I noticed that you are you're very close to ground zero.
Hudson Valley. Or in Wisconsin. Where?
Wisconsin.
And then in New York. No, in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Because there was an outbreak in New York area too, I thought.
Right.
Yeah.
But where you are now, you're really close to where ground zero was for that 3 million pen.
Oh, right. Tell us about that, Robert.
What a fiasco. You've never seen a fiasco covered up so professionally to appear that the authorities actually knew exactly what they were doing. And not only that, but that they were doing it humanely and sustainably. And they turned, the language they use is very interesting to me, because as someone who cares a lot about language and was in marketing communications for years, still a little bit, language and images and perceptions of things really matter a lot. For one thing, people trust veterinarians, right?
Yes.
So every state, including Wisconsin, the head of the person in charge of animal care is the state veterinarian. And in all the states, including Wisconsin, where this has played out, the state veterinarian has become kind of the spokesperson to the media and to the public, assuring everyone that everything is completely under control, that the disposal process is fine, and that it's composting rather than a dump site, a toxic dump site. And so in the Wisconsin case, neighbors are still seeing truckloads of dead birds in open trucks that were supposed to be sealed trucks, packed with dead birds. And when they're coming down the road, some birds falling out, feathers flying, dander feathers, allegedly, presumably, infected, which can carry the virus. So tonight, in fact, the latest is that there's a town hall in Palmyra. And so the village board president and the board are having a meeting to allow the neighbors to kind of air their grievances. You know what the big problem is, though? They tried to contact somebody from the state. They refused to be there at the meeting to answer any questions. They contacted somebody from SNR Egg Company, which owns millions of hens and has several factory farms in Wisconsin, is the single largest supplier of eggs in the state, 80% market share. No one from their SNR would come to the meeting to address residents' concerns. And yet they're telling the media that, oh yeah, we're talking to these neighbors. Yeah, everything's under control. They know exactly what's going on. No, they don't. So we were gonna go if a representative from SNR or the state were, even just the public communications officer, that's their job, right? To like face the public. One person in their organization couldn't come out to deal with this very serious issue. So it's, that just tells you there's a lot to hide. This is a cover-up. It's a massive cover-up. I was talking to a journalist who's writing a really in-depth story on this, and I won't mention her name, but she describes their behavior as fascist. And I thought that was really interesting. She said it's protecting corporate power at the expense of everyday people and animals and the planet, and shutting them out of the power structure, and the state using our tax dollars to protect, and using violence also to kind of use that perception of, the fear of violence in people's mind of what the state is capable of doing, wiping out millions of animals or people or whatever, but in this case, she described it as a form of fascism. And I thought, I've looked at it that way before, but not recently. I thought that was interesting.
So bird flu has happened before. It comes and goes. Certainly a lot of these viruses occur because animals are in dense conditions, and that's how it spreads easily. So do you have an idea about how many birds have been affected and how have they been taken care of?
Yeah. If we're looking at like cases across the US at this point, we're up to probably about 25 million. And so it's shaping up to be kind of similar to the 2015 outbreak. And I don't think we've seen the worst yet. I think this could continue for a while. I know that taxpayers will be asked, expected to clean up, to pay for the cleanup and the birds to replace them even from the hatcheries, those terrible hatcheries.
Right. So the businesses don't pay for them. We do.
Right.
Yeah, that's nice. And how are the birds killed? They are killed. They're not given a pill and they get better. They don't go to a hospital and get healed. They're just killed.
And I won't get into the gory details, but if you really want to know, there are three main ways that they're using now. There's something called ventilation shutdown, which is using heat, turning up the heat inside of these big barns, and causing the animals to have heat stroke and basically collapse from the heat.
And this happens over a period of hours. It doesn't happen right away.
Yeah, when you're dealing with populations that large, it can take hours, days.
Yeah.
I think in this Wisconsin case, they tried a bunch of different things and nothing was working right. And so that's why it took them like almost 3 weeks to kill these birds.
They know what they're doing and they have it under control.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. Trust me.
God. Yeah. No.
The other method, so there's ventilation shutdown, there's carbon monoxide gas, which sounds like, oh, you know, people die in their sleep of carbon monoxide poisoning and it's painless. But actually, under these conditions, it's not. It's very intense and it burns the lungs of the animals. It's very painful. And again, it could take hours or days. And the third way is incredibly heinous. It's called fire retardant foam. And a lot of environmentalists don't like that way because of the chemical. Fire retardant foam has got incredibly bad chemicals in it. And then what do you do with that waste? How do you dispose of that properly? It just becomes a waste disposal nightmare. But the foam suffocates. And none of those ways are, according to Karen Davis, I had a really nice conversation with her about a week ago, and she said none of these methods are painless. They're all drawn out. They're all awful. And I'm sure she's right. Yeah.
Just a moment about Karen Davis, another wonderful individual who is probably so outraged day in and day out by what happens to all of these birds. And then they're composted, you mentioned. And composting is a nice environmental way to degrade things. But I'm kind of remembering whenever you get instructions about what you should compost, it's usually plant material and that we should keep the animal material out of the compost, right? So how does that work?
Yeah,
or not?
Great question, because you were talking about soil earlier. And I would like to learn more about this because I'm no expert for sure, but my understanding is that there have been corpses and cadavers and bodies found that were buried that still have certain pathogens that are active after, hundreds of years. I don't know if you've seen cases of this, like anthrax and probably completely different things than bird flu. But still, pathogens can live for decades and hundreds of years in a body that's buried. So I'm not sure how they make the claim that the soil is ready to reuse, you know, within like weeks of the burial, 3 million births. I'm not sure how they come to that, but nobody really trusts that. And the neighbors that are surrounding this burial, you know, this site, which they want to call a compost site, the neighbors want to call it a dump site because that's what they see it as. Does anyone really know? I mean, what have they tested this? Like, how would you know that this happens so infrequently? Like, you don't have to dump 3 million birds every day. So how are you going to tell us that that's going to be easily available soil and within 3 weeks?
I'm just thinking about flies. And one of their functions is to go to other animals that are dead and kind of feed on them. And it kind of helps the process of breaking them down. And we can live without humans, but I've learned we cannot live without flies, or at least the earth cannot. They do amazing work, but they also fly. Flies fly. I mean, that's why we call them flies. So I'm imagining that they can feast a little on these contaminated birds and fly around and spread it a little bit.
Probably, yeah. I wish I knew, but the site is huge. It's like you got to see it to believe it.
Where all these dead birds are.
Yeah.
And, are there pictures online somewhere?
Yeah, we have some footage. So we have some, our drone footage unfortunately came too early. We thought that a week into this that they would be done, or they would be kind of completing. So we hired a drone pilot to get some footage, but they weren't even started after a week. So there is some chopper footage from a news station that shows some really good footage that I can send to you. But yeah, we're just like, this whole thing has just completely turned our world upside down. Like, you know.
So this bird flu is still going on around the country.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns we always have about animal viruses, flus like this one, Dr. Michael Greger wrote a book in 2015 and he updated it when the coronavirus came out in 2020, is that it is possible to leap from birds to humans. And if it's as contagious as it is and deadly as it is, it can just give us a whole nother fun round of pandemic to deal with. Something to look forward to.
Yeah. There's been 8 recent cases of bird to human transmission.
Yep. Of this particular one.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a 60% mortality rate.
Oh, that's good.
In humans. And there's been about 800 cases in humans up to now.
So those 8 people, did 4 of them die? 4 or 5 of them?
Don't know the outcomes. Don't know.
I'm just doing the math, you know, 60% times 8 is 4.8.
Yeah, right. So I don't know. But there's been 800 cases, and no, even though experts say, yeah, this is rare, they're still really concerned about how clever these series set of viruses are in mutating and adapting to different situations and animals. They're very worried about that. And they're, because of the fact that there's such a high mortality rate. So yeah, I mean, this is uncharted territory, and the situation we have is our tax dollars and our government that's supposed to, you know, oversee this and protect public health and the environment and animals. Instead, they're protecting corporate profits. It's one of the most blatant examples of that I've ever seen. Just staggering to me.
I want to take a moment and do a little public service announcement for the virus.
Please.
A little positive service announcement. So I was reading recently about viruses, and viruses throughout human history have had great benefits, and in some ways have been described in terms of the mutations that they cause. They give us upgrades, and we have upgraded or become better in many different ways because of viruses that have gotten into our bodies and done different things to us, and not just humans, but other living species as well. And partially because we are in such bad health as a society that the viruses that we deal with have negative impact on us. And if we were healthier, and I suppose the animals as well, if the animals were healthier and weren't grown in these filthy, dense environments, right, viruses that would come and go might have benefit instead of negative impact. So I don't want to knock all viruses out there. You know, there are good viruses and there are bad viruses, just like bacteria.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, absolutely. Protective bacteria, having good flora in your intestines.
Yep.
Is something obviously very important.
It's just fascinating when things are in balance and when things are out of balance, what happens?
Right. You know, I once read that avian flu and that set of viruses first became a problem when they can trace it back to when we started domesticating birds.
Well, of course.
And all of a sudden we started getting all of these strains of influenza. And even, I believe, even the regular influ, what we call flu, all those different strains of flu are related to bird flus that have evolved over the last, thousands of years. And especially since we've been exploiting birds for food.
So what is Free From Harm doing on this subject now, and what can the rest of us do?
Our latest action is calling on governors to actually do something serious if they want to stop bird flu or reduce the chances of humans and other animals getting bird flu. Right now, you'll see emergency orders in Illinois, New York, California by the governor saying no more poultry shows and exhibitions until further notice. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to a poultry show, but that's not the problem. Okay, that is not the issue. But these live animal markets where thousands of birds are cramped into these appalling conditions and workers are working in tight quarters with all of these birds, dander, feathers, even blood flying, all inhaling the encrusted feces, which is one of the surest ways to spread the virus, is encrusted feces that gets airborne. These live animal markets are the ideal conditions for this problem. So our campaign is telling the states, come on, get real. You want to solve this problem? Shut down these live animal markets. The poultry shows? Heh, what's going to happen to these poultry shows? Come on. And I get it that backyard chickens can get it from wild birds. But is that really going to be the vector for this becoming a serious problem in terms of numbers of animals suffering and dying, and then numbers of humans if this becomes a pandemic? I don't think so. I think it's really these factory farms that and these live markets that are we need to focus on. So we're trying to structure a campaign to the powers that be, the governors, the mayors, the Department of Ag directors, the state veterinarians who like to tell us everything is perfect and fine, that no, not everything is perfect and fine, and you need to do your job. And and stop trying to fool the public, because it's ridiculous at this point. Stop humane washing and greenwashing.
And we all need to remember or learn that birds like chickens, are kind and intelligent beings. There are so many lovely stories about these animals and the beautiful things that they do. Do you have any stories?
Oh yeah, I have stories for years. I have tons of great stories. I've had several rescued chickens. I had a few rescues from slaughterhouses that fell off the slaughterhouse truck. I rescued three, and I had two of them as companions for a short time before they died. One was paralyzed from the waist down, and the vet decided that the best thing was to euthanize the bird, even though he was eating and he was communicating, but he was paralyzed from the waist down. So I've had amazing experiences. I've had chickens that knew nothing but a barren warehouse for 6 weeks and then being stuffed in crates to be hauled off to the slaughterhouse. So who knew nothing except that, to coming into my home and skipping up and down stairs, doing things that like dogs or cats would probably take weeks to figure out, right? Mm. Doing things that just amaze you, like as if they've been there all this time and they just know exactly what to do and they know how to, you know, kind of coexist with us, and they're happy to do it and they're trusted. And you're like, how do they trust after being treated like that? And it's just amazing.
Well, I'm sure they could sense your energy just like I could. Oh, wow. I need to breathe. So much work to be done. And I just need to mention, of course, we have this war going on with Russia and Ukraine, and it's upsetting to many people, as it should be. And there are things that go on all around the world that are violent and terrible. But we have to acknowledge that even the people, the good people, the people that want to be acknowledged as good people, are part of this violent culture we live in, where we have these animals, we create them, we breed them, right. We confine them, we allow them to live in agony, in filth, and then we consume them.
Right.
This is our culture. We are mad.
Right.
I really feel like our culture is mad, insane, and there's only a few who are not.
And to what extent is this societal pressures on people that cause them to participate in something that they would admit is just like with fascist Germany and all the study that was done on people that went through that and why they chose to defend it, why they chose to live through it and justify it until they couldn't. And I just wonder, like, it just shows that how powerful societal pressures are and what social animals we are. And what we can learn, I guess, to me, that makes me want to learn more about social psychology. How do we disrupt that? How can we most efficiently impactfully.
I hate the word efficient too. Thank you.
I mean, like, how can we disrupt that process and say, wait a minute, you know, to get that message out to people that following norms is, in this case, or in past, we should learn our lessons from, like, how do we, it's got to be a disruption. It's got to be like, whoa, you know, you got to break that train of thought. It can't just be, I don't think it can be gradually and nicely put on people. I think it has to be a painful process, like mentally, like, oh my God, yeah, a wake up call that really, it's going to be upsetting to realize that you've been participating in something that goes against your most basic beliefs.
I think that's part of the problem, because for those that might get a glimmer and realize what they're doing, it's too difficult to say, I've been doing horrible things all my life and I'm not going to anymore. That's why I say, especially as an adult, it takes so much courage to change your diet and to change your way of thinking, because it's hard to acknowledge the harm that we've caused.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know.
All right, let's turn this around. I always like to end on happy, delicious notes. So I had the wonderful opportunity, me and my partner, Gary, we met you and Tom in Chicago last week, and we dined at Fancy Plants. It was wonderful.
We took a chance
on Fancy Plants.
Right. Because our first plan was to go to Althea, and we found that they had these ridiculous reservations, like from four o'clock on through the rest of the evening. I should have made it early, much earlier in advance, but I just didn't think it would be an issue. But so, yeah, I mean, as an alternative to Althea, and next time we'll try Althea, it really worked out well. There was room. We weren't packed in. It was nice and roomy. The food was great, and the company was wonderful.
Company was exceptional. So you had the dish that I'm definitely going to go back to try. You had that mushroom pot pie, and it was comforting and creamy and rich and yummy.
Yes, all of that.
And all of that. I like the dish I had. It was, I love bean curd skin. That's a thing. Some people call it yuba, and I find it, especially when it has to be flavored, because it's kind of bland if it isn't. And what is bean curd skin? Who knows, everybody? When you're cooking soy milk, and what is soy milk? Take a soybean and squeeze the liquid out of it. That's the milk. And then you separate the fiber, and you could use that for something else. And then you cook that milk. And if you've ever cooked milk, dairy milk or soy milk, it gets a skin on top.
Yeah.
And then you kind of lift that skin. You've got to have the right tools, because it's challenging. I've tried to do it at home. Don't try this at home. And then you hang this skin, and then it can dry. It's still kind of moist, but you can season it, marinate it, and then use it like skin. You can roll it up and fill things with it. It's just amazingly delicious. And this place used that skin, but also fried it. So it was kind of crispy on the outside. And then they had one of these, if you've ever been in an Asian restaurant and you've had those buns, those filled buns.
Yeah.
It was that dough.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a plum sauce and some others. It was just really flavorful and very different.
Yeah. You almost wish that, like, you could try different, but like, you almost wish you had some options where you could get a little bit of a sampling of different things on the menu, you know?
That depends. I've been to, it's a thing, you know, where people just serve little things and right. You go around and you sample, and that's trended for a while. I'm not a fan of that, because, you know, I like to really get to know a dish. Yeah. And really get into it. And what's interesting, I think, because they say, and I'm using air quotes here, that when you have a meat dish, it's the first bite that's flavorful to you, and then the rest of it doesn't really go anywhere because that's just the way meat works. But with plant food, you get flavor in every bite.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
So I just enjoy the flavor every bite over and over and over and focus on it. I'm the kind of person that likes to eat one thing at a time. If I have like three or four things on a plate,
sure,
I'll work at one and then move around. That's my thing.
Well, if we ever can get, I have a friend who wants to open up a kind of a high-end vegan restaurant. And he's looking into it, but in the meantime, he's fine-tuning his skills. So he occasionally has these dinner parties, and they're just incredible.
Okay, well, let him have one while I'm in Wisconsin, and I'll drive over to Chicago.
I will see what I can do to make that happen, because I think you would be quite dazzled by he's really good. He's really creative, and I'm sure that if he really gets this going, he'll be successful.
Well, that's the most wonderful thing of all about this lifestyle, the food that is so incredibly delicious, no deprivation, it's good for you, it's good for the planet, and I just want everybody to come on board.
Right. And help them overcome whatever obstacles they see. I think we should make it psychologically, there's some issues that might be difficult for people, but in terms of like the mechanics of it, it's not, it's difficult. If you have, the access to what you need, and it's just some of the psychological barriers, and it goes back to maybe what we were talking about in terms of societal pressures, and what role that plays in whether or not people make this change. And I feel like for every vegan like us who's like telling them what a great thing this is, they've got like, what, 5 or 10 other friends that are saying, oh no, just, keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, it's insane. It's just insane. That's the only word I have for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, Robert, thank you for being sane in this crazy world.
I never said I was sane.
It's such a joy to talk with you and listen to you and hear your sense and hear about the wonderful work that you're doing. And I'm so happy to be able to share it with the It's All About Food community. And we're going to have to say goodbye now.
Well, thank you. And, what makes it all worthwhile, I think, is these kind of conversations and friends, because if we didn't have our friends in our community, I don't know. I don't know how we keep our sanity than that.
I'm right there with you. Anyway, thank you so much. And I'm giving you that big, this is audio, you can't see it, but I'm giving Robert a big punch here, hoping that you get that big disruptive punch to change the world.
That's what we do now in place of a handshake.
Okay. Thank you. Take care. Be well. And everybody, have a delicious week.